From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why the Michigan Chamber of Commerce is staying neutral on the road funding proposal.
Although there's strong agreement that we need to fix the roads, there is not a consensus within our membership to either support or oppose Proposal 1.
Talking bipartisanship with U.S. Senator Gary Peters.
There's so much more that we agree on than we disagree on, so let's spend some time focusing on those things that are clearly going to bring people together.
We meet the only man to survive a famous Lake Huron shipwreck.
I just didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want to be the only survivor. And I tried to hide the fact that I was.
And John U. Bacon on Michigan State's March Madness prospects.
So not a high seed, not a great Michigan State team, but 18 straight has got to get your attention and your respect. That is hard to do.
The rise of social media and online commenting is giving us infinitely more opportunities to be uncivil. Is that hurting our economic prospects?
In order for the next generation to have a voice and to engage in this civil behavior, we really have to set the precedent now.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the search for civility. But first, when he was elected to the U.S. Senate, Gary Peters promised us he would approach his job in a spirit of bipartisan cooperation. And that's exactly what's behind the first two bills he's introduced in the Senate. Senator Gary Peters is with us now from Washington. Very good to have you back.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you.
I want to start with the Federal Vehicle Repair Cost Savings Act, a bill you've co-sponsored with Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford. And I know this was a cause that you were working on when you were in the House as well. What would this bill do?
Well, what this bill does is it reduces the repair cost for the fleet of vehicles that the federal government maintains. In fact, the federal government spends nearly $1 billion every year maintaining the vehicle fleet all across the country. And my bill with the Senator Lankford encourages the government to use remanufactured parts in those repairs, which are considerably less expensive. They also use a lot less energy to make, which is part of the reason why they're so much less expensive, to reduce those costs. And it's also good for Michigan in the fact that remanufactured motor vehicle parts is a big industry here in Michigan, and that means a lot of jobs for Michigan while also reducing the cost to taxpayers. And I'm happy to say that our bill, I introduced it last week, and just this week it passed out of Senate committee on a unanimous vote. And now goes to the Senate floor for full consideration.
I would suspect most anyone listening would say, well, I do it for my car, so Uncle Sam ought to do it for his fleet.
Well, there's no question about that, and that's why we want to make sure. Sometimes the government, when they see a requirement for the lowest cost, and they do bid this out, they think that they have to stick with original parts. And certainly that's not the case. We know from a safety standpoint, remanufactured parts are often fully warrantied, and they are considerably cheaper. You know, as an example, a passenger bus alternator that if you buy it new cost about $1,300. You can get a fully warrantied alternator for about $850, which is a pretty big savings. And I'm happy to say that those kinds of parts are the kinds of parts that we make across Michigan as well.
And then there's the Military Reserve Small Business Jobs Act of 2015, and you're working with Iowa Republican Senator Jody Ernst on this one. And we know you served as a CB combat warfare specialist, and you rose to lieutenant commander in the Naval Reserve, and you re-upped in the Naval Reserve after 9/11. And, of course, Senator Ernst is well-known, the first female veteran to serve in the Senate, a lieutenant colonel in the Iowa National Guard. So clearly this is something very close to your collective hearts.
Well, it is. It's something that we know firsthand from the men and women who we served with. And when reservists, if they are called to active duty and leave their families as citizen soldiers and sailors, when they report to active duty, oftentimes their military pay is less than what they receive in the civilian world. And what this bill deals with is the differential. What will happen when a reservist is called up, oftentimes their employer will make up the difference between what the military is paying them and what they would be getting in their civilian job. And that's frequently done with large companies. Large companies can afford it. They're also very patriotic and want to help that service man or woman. However, it's more difficult if you're a small business owner. You just don't have the resources. So our bill deals with small businesses to help them with paying that differential if they choose to do that for their employee. And what it says is if you're a business with 50 or fewer employees, and if you pay that differential to a reservist who has been activated, you can get a 20% tax credit to help you make that differential, because we certainly believe a man or woman called to active duty shouldn't have to worry about the bills at home while they're defending our country and serving our country.
And I would suspect this is an issue that won't get a lot of pushback from anyone.
It shouldn't. I hope it it doesn't, and that's why it's important to work, though, in a bipartisan way. It's why both of these bills are bills that I have reached out to my Republican colleagues, and I'm happy to say they're two of my freshman Republican colleagues as well. So we are hitting the ground running.
Well, and you and I have talked about this when you were first elected, that you really did intend to do exactly what you're saying, reaching out to Republican colleagues. And interesting, both freshmen. And I'm wondering, as you're kind of getting into the Senate and getting that feel of it, what do you see as the key to greater bipartisan cooperation? I mean, both of these bills are ones that are not particularly inflammatory, but it's certainly promising, I think, for the public to see, you know, both sides of the aisle joining together.
And that's right. That's what you have to do. You have to start with bills like these. These are things that we can agree on. And if you really look at all of the challenges and issues that we face as a country, there's so much more that we agree on than we disagree on. So let's spend some time focusing on those things that are clearly going to bring people together, build those relationships. And then when you build those relationships and have some trust between you, then you can deal with the tougher issues as well. So, you know, I look forward to doing that. The Senate, the nice thing about it, it's a smaller body than what I'm used to in the U.S. House. And so it's an opportunity to get to know people much more on an individual basis, which would I have done with these two colleagues. And I look forward to continuing to do that. But I find you start with these bills and then you build up to more controversial ones. But you've got to start building trust.
Senator Gary Peters, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside. Always good to talk with you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The winds of change are blowing at Toyota. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now with his weekly check-in. And you say in your column today, some changes at the top ranks at Toyota are offering some powerful symbolism. What's happening?
Yeah, for the first time, they are elevating some Americans into some very key positions. They've already got a single American, Mark Hogan from General Motors, has been a director on their board for several years now. But they've announced as of April 1st that a former GM executive, Julie Hamp, is going to be their chief communications officer worldwide. They are elevating a Frenchman to executive vice president and to the a seat on the board. And for the first time, an American will be the chief legal officer for the company, based both in the U.S. and in Japan. These are, I think, very significant moves by Toyota, which has really been a truly Japanese company, despite the fact that they spent a lot of time trying to convince people that they were an American company, when in fact they really were not, in terms of the way they were managed, nor the way they were obviously owned and controlled. But this is very significant, and I think you see this happening in other companies as well in the industry, where you're getting a much more of an internationalization of the top leadership at very high levels. General Motors has done this as well.
Yeah, you say, you know, finally you're seeing companies acknowledging reality. Give us a sense of some of these faces and who these folks are.
At Toyota?
Well, we talked about Toyota, but I know General Motors. We've got...
At GM, for example, you've got the person that heads their Opel operations in Europe is a German that came from Volkswagen. The guy that heads their international operations in Asia is also a German who worked for a long time at Volkswagen and also at Volvo. The new global head of Cadillac is South African and spent a lot of years in the German auto industry at Audi particularly, and is credited with really bringing Audi back in the United States, among other things. And I just think what's happening here is there's a recognition that you need, if you're going to compete globally, you need people who have truly global experience in different perspectives. What's even more important here is they're not just putting them in jobs, they're putting them in leadership positions where they can affect corporate strategy at the board level or total global positioning. And I think it's very significant, and it's a step that Toyota is really trying to align management of the company with where they're doing business.
Now, we certainly have seen this at Chrysler because of the marriage with Fiat. Are we seeing the same thing happening at Ford?
Yeah, to a lesser extent, I think. You know, Ford has a long history of having British executives in high ranks, and they still have some of that. But I think, as I look at some of that, I think you have a little bit less of that. It's a little bit different culture. GM has been very aggressive about it, and particularly so after coming out of bankruptcy. They had some problem spots they had to deal with, and they've dealt with them by going out and essentially pursuing what you might call the best available athlete strategy.
As you point out in your piece today, it is that crisis moment. whether it's the bankruptcy for GM or certainly with Toyota's sudden acceleration crisis, that kind of pushes you into new fields, doesn't it?
It can, but I think there's also a recognition here. I mean, let's be honest. There's a recognition here that you have a whole generation of particularly women that have matured up through the ranks of the last 25 years and are now ready for prime time, and they've earned it. And Julie Hamp is a good example of that. Mary Barr at General Motors is a good example of that. There are a number of other women in very senior positions at GM. About a third of their officers are women. It's just different, and it reflects the market we operate in today. It's not just a bunch of men that are buying cars and trucks around the world. And women are very involved in that. They influence purchase decisions, and they make purchase decisions. And I think the companies have finally wised up to that, and their leadership, both in management and the board level, reflects that.
New faces at the executive head tables. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
And a reminder, Governor Rick Snyder will be taking your questions this coming Monday morning. The governor will join Michigan Radio for a Michigan Calling special. It'll be hosted by State Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. You often hear him right here on Stateside. You can submit questions in advance via Facebook at Michigan Calling or Twitter using the hashtag #AmICalling. A live video feed of the program will also be available. Just go to MichiganRadio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of a confrontation between civil rights marchers and Alabama state troopers, the confrontation known as Bloody Sunday. That event sparked the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Thousands of people will gather in Selma, Alabama this weekend commemorating that 50th anniversary, including my next guest, Gloria Mills. She's a retired teacher and librarian with the Detroit Public Schools. Gloria Mills, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Tell us what happened on that Sunday in 1965.
Well, from what I could remember, the whole civil rights thing, there was something going on almost all of the time. And that particular time, it came to a head because Jimmie Lee Jackson had been shot by police, and they were going to originally take his coffin to the Capitol in Montgomery. That was the purpose of going from Selma to Montgomery. But as everybody knows, the powers that be, the governor's office, was not going to let them do that. So that's when the people were beaten back literally so that they couldn't cross the bridge.
And that was hundreds of protesters, wasn't it?
Yes. And there are people like John Lewis who are alive and well today who can tell you all about it. And that's the amazing thing. That's to have the living history, and people need to know that and never forget it.
So the commemoration of Bloody Sunday, that terrible day on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, what will be happening during your trip? What will you be seeing and doing?
Okay, first of all, a lot of the people have never really been there, been in Alabama. A lot of them haven't been south, okay? We're going to see some of the historic sites and literally see the places where the people actually were. And the folks in Selma do an excellent job of putting together a series of workshops and very great educational things. They bring in as many people who they call foot soldiers who were there and took part in the march. So it's just a very excellent time to hear some personal histories of the people who were there. Too often we read what I call Reader's Digest versions of things that happen in history, and it's up to the person writing to talk about what they think is important. This way you get to hear from the people who were there. And that's why I find it such a valuable place to go and such a great event to participate in.
Gloria, you are a retired teacher. You're a librarian.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, from that perspective, what are your thoughts about what that history from 50 years ago will teach us for today?
Well, first of all, because of all the electronics and so forth, young people today are only into popular culture. They have about a history in themselves of about 4 or 5 years, so they have a hard time even dealing with 50 years, but they need to be able to do that. So that's why I find it to be so important, because people forget too easily the things that people went through to get them to a certain point. So that's what I think is very important, that history is important, because if you don't know your history, it's so easy to repeat it. And we're seeing things now the suppression of voter rights and all of those kinds of things that people fought for. And people need to be conscious of it so we won't lose the things that had been gained.
Yes, I wondered if you are watching things that are happening in the news and things, decisions being made. And
oh, yeah.
That you're concerned about keeping those voting rights intact.
Oh, definitely. We can't afford to lose any kind of rights on any level. So that's why it's also very important. And some people are aware and some aren't. And once again, younger people who weren't around 50 years ago, they need to know it and see it and all those kinds of things to be conscious of what can happen if they're not vigilant about people's rights.
Retired teacher and librarian Gloria Mills, who's organizing a bus trip to Selma, Alabama. They're leaving today, marking the 50th anniversary this weekend of Bloody Sunday. Gloria, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Safe to say, for most of us, the closest we will ever get to a shipwreck is listening to Gordon Lightfoot singing about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. But my next guests are quite an exception to that. Both will be speakers at the 34th Great Lakes Shipwreck Festival. It's happening Saturday at Washtenaw Community College. Dave Trotter is a veteran shipwreck hunter. He'll be talking about one of the most famous sinkings on the Great Lakes, the November 1966 sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Dennis Hale really, really knows about shipwrecks. Dennis was the only survivor of the Morrell's crew of 29, and he is with us, too. Dennis, very, very good to talk with you.
Good to be here today.
David, in the hierarchy of Great Lakes shipwrecks, where would you put the Daniel J. Morrell?
Certainly it is one of the major shipwrecks, one of the top three or four. And in the context, you had the Carl Bradley lost in Lake Michigan in 58. You had the Daniel J. Morrell lost in Lake Huron in 1966, and, of course, the Fitz in Lake Superior in 1975. So you're really talking about three gigantic lakes and three gigantic shipwrecks, all in November.
All in November. Dennis, you were, what, 26?
Yes, ma'am. I was 26 at the time.
And a watchman on the Morrell, and it was the early, early wee hours of the morning, November 29th, 1966. Where was the ship at that time, Dennis?
We were headed northbound, going up to Taconite Harbor, Minnesota, when she finally broke and there was a loss of life.
Yes. And now, did I read correctly? You were actually sleeping at the time that that things got bad?
Yes, that's correct. I was in bed sleeping. I was awakened by a loud bang, and that was the ship cracking. And then within a few minutes, I was in the water. I think they figured it was 8 minutes from the time the general alarm sounded until I was in the water.
And you were in the water and wearing what?
Life jacket, a pea coat, and a pair of undershorts.
Boy.
I was out there for 38 hours like that.
Now, you made your way to a raft?
Yes, I made my way to a raft, and there I had three other companions with me. And they passed away after, I think it was like 14 hours. And then I was out there another 24 before the Coast Guard picked me up. I was out there for a total of 38 hours, dressed only in a life jacket, a pea coat, and a pair of undershorts.
What do you most remember? Is it still very, very, very acute and vivid in your memory?
Well, I live it every day in one way or another. Yes, it's very vivid.
What do you remember? What was that like?
You know, you just can't explain something like that in a few words. And it's just hard to give a summary of something that traumatic.
Yeah. And it just, do you, I know you must have spent all these intervening years wondering why you were the only one to make it and the three men who were on that raft with you didn't, much less let alone the rest of the crew.
Well, I still wonder about that.
Yeah.
I just, you know, it's just hard to believe. And, you know, I think about it more so now that I'm growing older. When it first happened, I just didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want to be the only survivor. And I tried to hide the fact that I was. But after so many years, it's just impossible not to be him.
And what is it like for you when you're sharing your memories? Is there kind of a sense of, use the word healing when you do that?
It's very cathartic for me. I mean, you know, at first when I was talking, there were things I wouldn't talk about. I guess maybe maybe I was ashamed to be the only survivor. Maybe I saw some fault in that. But as you know, as I grow older and I start talking about it more, it is very cathartic for me.
I'm talking with Dennis Hale, who was the sole survivor of the November 1966 sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell. And with him here on the program with us today is David Trotter, who is a veteran shipwreck hunter. And David, you found the wreck of the Morrell in 1979. What'd you find?
Well, we actually had two steps, and they really were amazing and almost divine intervention. And the first was that the stern had been located by the Coast Guard within about 60 days after the breakup and the loss of the Morrell. And they did that to cut a piece of small steel out of along the break and analyze and determine the reason that the ship was actually lost. This was way offshore, and there's no technology at the time for positioning. So other people who had an interest in the Morrell itself, very hard to get offshore and even locate. There was no GPS, no Loran, no devices for positioning that are so common today. And I had one of the first pieces of technology that would allow some positioning. And basically, we were able to calculate the location of the stern, walk out to it on a very beautiful Sunday. And I say walk, we drive out very carefully, 13 miles offshore roughly. And miraculously, because of this new technology, I was able to pinpoint the stern of the Morrell. We were just ecstatic as a group of team of divers. And we made the initial dive, verified we had the stern. In very poor visibility, because it's Saginaw Bay, very limited, very deep, 220 feet of water, and using what standard air, which has a certain narcotic effect to it. But aside from that, we made this event happen. We're extremely excited and just elated about it. And we decided, because the weather was still good, we'd move 5 miles further away and continue searching. Now, just picture, walk 5 miles away, random direction. Within 20 minutes, we had another target. We went back weeks later and realized that we had discovered the other half of the missing Daniel J. Morrell.
After all those years, I can only imagine for you just kind of having that sense of, okay, it's all found, and just kind of hard to put into words, I'm sure.
Yes, it is. It's very hard for me to realize what I did go through, and that I'm still alive. I just turned 75, and I'm still going strong.
And so finding those two pieces, did that kind of help put together what happened, or was it pretty well known already?
In large part, Dennis was a significant contributor to the story of what happened to the Morrell. But, of course, there's something that he felt very personal about and oftentimes wished not to talk about until years later, after the bow had been discovered 13 years later in our involvement. And we learned many things about it, from the style of the break, the fact that it ended up perfectly upright on the bottom, that we could actually see the binoculars that might have been used as they looked at the Morrell breaking in two, the radio phone that was hanging out through the window, the intact pilot house, the name board, the entire bell still in place. Just an amazing experience for people of history and wreck hunters.
That has to be, for you, very emotional. When you describe the detail of what you saw and how
the unique thing about contributing to Great Lakes marine history in the form of the exploration and diving is that when you leave the surface, an example is 2015 today, but you may go back 150 years on a shipwreck or a site. It's just a drop back into time in a matter of 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, certainly we can tell shipwrecks hold great fascination for the public, and the fact that this is the 34th Great Lakes Shipwreck Festival bears that out. And Dennis Hale and David Trotter and many more speakers will be there this Saturday at Washtenaw Community College. You can get all the information at the website shipwreckfestival.us. Dennis Hale and David Trotter, it was a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm sure this is just a tiny taste of what you'll be talking about this Saturday at the Shipwreck Festival. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Great, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We're a little more than a week away from Selection Sunday. That's when we learn who's going to the big dance, the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. And John, big win on senior night for the Spartans last night, 72-66 over Purdue. You've been saying all along you see them headed toward their 18th straight NCAA tournament.
And they almost certainly are now. They've got one game left, of course, in the Big Ten. Then you've got the Big Ten tournament.
Right now, they're in a big logjam of teams tied at 11-6 in the conference, but with various tiebreakers, they're the third seed in the Big Ten tournament, not the NCAA tournament. But they're almost certainly going to make it the tournament, probably as a 10 seed somewhere in there. So not a high seed, not a great Michigan State team, but 18 straight has got to get your attention and your respect. That is hard to do.
And they've had, since you and I talked a couple weeks ago, kind of reviewing the fortunes of Michigan State and Michigan, Michigan State's had some tough losses. Free throw problems?
Free throw problems, which, by the way, will drive a coach crazy.
Yes. Well, we have seen video of Coach Izzo on the sidelines when he is going crazy. You wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of that
scolding. No, you wouldn't. And Izzo and Beilein, John Beilein, yeah, of course, the coach at Michigan, are temperamentally very different. Izzo on the sidelines never looks happy. You and I have joked about this.
Yes.
you miss a couple free throws down the stretch, you're even unhappier. What's amazing about the free throw is the shot your eighth grade kids take is the same as the high school kids, same as the college kids, same as the NBA guys. That free throw never, ever changes. It is bowling. Same 10 pins, same lane, same distance, all this stuff. And it always amazes me when teams are not good at this. That is one thing. If I was coaching basketball, and trust me, I never will for a lot of good reasons, I would go over that. I swear to God, I'd spend 20 minutes a day on that.
Yeah, there were some pretty tough losses. Speaking of, here's Michigan riddled with injuries, but they really battled hard on Tuesday night on the road against Northwestern. Double overtime and then a tough loss. But gutsy, and I'm wondering, what does it tell you about what we might expect next season?
Next season is what you're talking about if you're a Michigan fan. John Beilein, as we've said, and that was my essay here at Michigan Radio last week, he's an amazing coach and an amazing guy. That is one problem you simply don't have. I recall at some point President Slissel asking one of his trusted lieutenants, how come I'm not getting any emails about basketball? Because, of course, football was on fire all fall, basically. And the answer is very simple, and it's a great line from Carol Hutchins, the softball coach. He said, even in a down year, a good program is a good program. This is undeniably a down year. They're not even 500. They might not even make the National Invitational Tournament, which is the NIT, which is the poor man's NCAA. But the team is playing the game the right way. Everyone's still working hard. You saw the Ohio State game a couple weeks ago. Beat a team with really one hand tied behind their back. They had no business beating those guys. Where they shot themselves in the foot was early on. They had diabolically bad losses to the New Jersey Institute of Technology.
I remember that.
I lived in New Jersey for a year. I didn't know the place existed. The gym is like a junior high school gym. Then they lost the next game to EMU, and that back-to-back is kind of a killer right there. But it's been a hard luck season, and wait till next year. You might lose Caris LeVert, the star.
That's what I wondered. Who
to the NBA. He is investigating his possibilities right now.
Let's pivot over for a moment to Coach Jim Harbaugh. We all heard how he, you know, he's come to save the Wolverines, but he winds up coming to the aid of those two drivers involved in that crash on I-94. And I know you were saying he really didn't want a lot of publicity, but it's certainly a big story.
Yeah.
And then we find out in just 2 months that he's been on the job, he has amassed enough Twitter followers to make him second only to Urban Meyer at Ohio State. And there is something to all of this, isn't there, as far as your public image?
Oh, there's no question.
The honeymoon period.
And I guarantee you also, most coaches would never do any of this were it not for recruiting. You don't see NFL coaches doing this because they draft players. They pay them. These guys have got to have a presence. Certainly 17-year-old football players are watching Twitter. I obviously follow him. I'm pleased to report he follows me. I'm one of his 70 followers, although I'm sure he's disappointed in what I'm putting out. So not that interesting. But nonetheless, follow me on Twitter. Why don't you? with that marketing pitch. What's fascinating about this honeymoon is it's Jim himself recognizes this, but he is trying to avoid the Messiah complex at all turns. They don't want publicity for this. It's pretty hard to avoid. And the joke I put on my Twitter account was reports say that they hid the capes before the media showed up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting almost absurd. The two women in question are recovering. It was a serious accident.
Yeah.
And the two women in question had no idea who these guys were.
Which makes it kind of like a little movie episode in a sense. But really, capitalizing on this honeymoon period with all of this is not a bad thing for his future effectiveness.
No question. That's why it's kind of, I think, first class to not mention this, to not seek attention. They sent out a press release through Dave Abeloff. Read the police reports. That's it. So that's to his credit. You could have milked this for recruiting, and he's not.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon, as always, thanks, John.
Cindy, always a pleasure.
Coming up next, why the Michigan Chamber of Commerce is staying neutral on Prop 1. Then, the need for civility. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Lansing spent much of 2014 debating the crumbling roads and how to find the money to fix them, One of the strongest voices calling for action was that of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. We've often spoken with Executive Director Rich Studley here on Stateside as he expressed the group's frustration with Lansing's inability to figure out a road funding solution. Rich Studley is with us now. Hello, Rich.
Good afternoon.
I still remember your very memorable and perfectly put quote last June when the state Senate couldn't cough up any kind of a road funding solution. And your words were, nobody's being asked to build a spaceship to Mars, that this is something lawmakers across the country do on a regular basis. And now we have Proposal 1 up for a vote on May 5th. Why is the Michigan Chamber staying neutral, especially when you've been so vocal about the need to fix the roads?
I think across the state, almost everyone agrees we need to fix the roads, and I'm confident that sooner or later that will happen. Instead of pursuing a legislative solution, at the end of last year, the governor and legislative leaders chose to put a proposal on the ballot. That proposal is an amendment to the state constitution, and tie-barred or linked to that proposed amendment to the state constitution are about 10 different bills or pieces of legislation. If the ballot proposal is approved, an increase in the sales tax would take effect along with related legislation. If it's not approved, back to the drawing board. The challenge for the Michigan Chamber is that for over 30 years, we've been very member-driven and policy-focused. That's why in the past we have been a strong advocate to fix the roads and improve public transit. The direction we've received from our members in the past has been to pursue that policy objective through the legislative process with user fees. Now voters have a very important decision to make on May 5th, and we've spent the last 2 months here at the Michigan Chamber gathering information from a wide range of sources, listening very carefully to all of our members, and this week we completed that comprehensive review process and announced that within the Michigan Chamber's membership, and here at the State Chamber, we have a very large and diverse membership. We represent companies of every size and type in all 83 of Michigan's counties, that although there's strong agreement that we need to fix the roads, there is not a consensus or strong agreement within our membership to either support or oppose Proposal 1 on May 5th. So we announced that we would not be taking a position for or against the ballot proposal. Between now and May 5th, the role that we will play is educational or informational. We will be working to educate and inform our members about the content of the ballot proposal so that business people are prepared to get out and vote on May 5th and to participate in that important decision.
If we were talking last year and we were looking into a crystal ball, would you be surprised to realize that the membership had decided that you're going to stay neutral on this because the road funding was so important?
Well, there was strong agreement or a consensus within our membership to pursue a legislative solution to this problem. When the governor and legislative leaders chose to address the issue by going to the ballot, for years and years here at the Michigan Chamber, whenever an issue transitions from the legislative process to the ballot, we go back to our members. And I think it's understandable that people look at a proposed amendment to the state constitution and have questions or concerns. The state's constitution is our most important political document. And I think part of the challenge here is the complexity of the proposed solution, that there are a number of laws that are tie-barred or linked to this. So it's a complicated proposal, but it is a very important proposal. And I think people of goodwill can look at this ballot proposal and reach different conclusions. And frankly, for an organization like ours, that was also part of the challenge. We have some members who support the proposal, others who are opposed, and many are still undecided about the proposal. Typically, when we weigh in on a ballot proposal, is a consensus or a high level of agreement, and there just isn't that consensus or high level of agreement within our membership at this time.
You have been all along in this process pretty open in praising Governor Snyder for this battle that he's waging, an uphill battle to try to fix the roads. And now he is trying to get Prop 1 passed because what we hear is if it doesn't pass, there's no plan B. I'm just wondering, why not give him a boost with the chamber's support rather than taking no position at all?
Michigan Chamber members and staff are very supportive of Governor Rick Snyder. But now the question before us is a proposed amendment to the state constitution and related legislation. Again, there's just not a consensus or strong agreement within our membership on the content of the proposal. So it's not about the process or personalities. It's about the ballot proposal itself, the direction that we have received after listening to our members and carefully evaluating the proposal is we think the most important role for us to play is to educate and inform business people. Whatever the decision is on May 5th, we want to encourage people to get out and vote so that a strong message is sent to Lansing.
It might seem, kind of looking at this action, that Michigan's business community does indeed want the roads fixed, but maybe doesn't want to put skin in the game by supporting an increase in the state sales tax from 6% to 7%. Is that any kind of a fair view?
I can't speak for other groups other than to note that within the business community, there are other organizations that we work with on a regular basis, and some are in favor and some are opposed, and many organizations have either not taken a position or do not plan to take a position and are also playing an educational or informational role. In that regard, business people are not unlike the general electorate. Almost everyone wants to fix the roads. The question is Proposal 1 on May 5th the right way to go about it? If you believe that's the case, you should vote yes. If you believe that that's not the right way to go about solving this problem, then you have another option available, and it's really not our role at this point to encourage people to vote yes or vote no. It is just to encourage people to study the proposal carefully, listen to the arguments for and against, and make sure that they get out and vote on May 5th. Whatever the result is, we would hope that it's a clear and strong message.
And if Prop 1 loses after May 5th, what action do you see the chamber taking? How will you get back in the road funding fight?
Well, first, I don't want to speculate on the outcome of the election. Frankly, I just don't know whether this proposal will pass or fail, and that really wasn't a part of our thinking. As I mentioned earlier, across the state, I think there's strong agreement that we need to fix the roads and improve public transit. So if the proposal is approved, the issue will be addressed. If the proposal is not approved, the problem won't go away, and in fact, it will get worse. The legislature and the administration will need to go back to the drawing board.
Rich Studley is the executive director of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Rich, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Collaborative, part of the community. The next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
Remember the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you? We know it, but it seems too many of us in 2015 perhaps have forgotten it. Whether it's driving, commenting online, debate in the Capitol, both Washington and Lansing, it seems that we experience incivility just about everywhere we turn. At the recent Detroit Regional Chamber's policy conference, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan called for a new way of thinking.
Away from us versus them and toward collaboration. We're not going to attack people. We're not going to criticize people. We're going to pull people together.
Well, our latest contributor to The Next Idea echoes that very sentiment in her essay. Emily Bank is a grad student in adult higher education at Michigan State University. She's president of MSU's Council of Graduate Students, and she's author of a white paper titled Cultivating a Civil Society in an Era of Incivility. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you think, Emily, is contributing to this rise of incivility in our culture?
Well, I think that we view incivility in our daily lives, whether it's driving down the street, whether it's entering into a debate in one of our classes. So it's really just all-encompassing in our daily lives.
What do you think is contributing to that?
I think largely it's what we view on social media and in comment sections on different news sites. There is that freedom that's given to us by the First Amendment to always voice our opinions and kind of engage in this dialogue. But at the same time, you see a lot of harsh comments and kind of butting heads on different issues. So I think increasingly with the rise of this digital era, we're seeing an increase in incivility.
Yeah, as you put it in your white paper, just because it's protected by the First Amendment doesn't mean it's civil.
Right.
Would you say that we are more uncivil to each other now than we were in the past? I mean, we have had some pretty uncivil chapters in our nation's history, haven't we?
Right. And I don't think that this incivility is a new concept in the United States or even internationally. I think incivility has definitely penetrated our civil discourse throughout history, an increase in war throughout America's history. I don't think it's anything new.
How do you think people profit? Who do you think profits from this current state of incivility?
I believe that definitely news media outlets profit. I think it's entertaining to see incivility and to see the butting of heads from different political parties, people with different opinions, and I think that makes it a profitable industry. But I think that politics in and of itself also benefits from this incivility because of the alliances to the political parties. And those two, especially distinct political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, I think you see it daily in media how polarized our political climate currently is.
And then what's the result of that? How does this incivility and this gridlock hurt us as a state and as a nation?
I really think that it hurts the democratic process, and we can't get down to creating these innovative new solutions because of this gridlock and those conflicting ideologies. And I really think that in order for the next generation to have a voice and to engage in this civil behavior, we really have to set the precedent now.
And for just average citizens, people who are not in a position of power, a position to make policy, What's the impact on people? Do we just start tuning everything out and sticking our heads in the sand, or do we get bitter, or what do you think happens?
Right. I think it's an interesting paradigm that we're seeing because in this digital age, we're constantly connected. So you're always seeing those comments. It's really right in front of you. But at the same time, we want to disconnect because I think the modern person is so sick of the fighting that's going on and that we're seeing. So it's really an interesting paradigm because we're constantly connected, but we do want to kind of disconnect and distance ourselves from all the animosity.
We often talk on The Next Idea about the importance of collaboration to find new ideas and come up with creative solutions to problems in Michigan. So all of this incivility and this feeling of being disenfranchised, that's really a hurdle to overcome.
It is, yep. And I think that we're taking some great steps, especially in the Lansing community, to increase the level of civility. For example, inspiring collective action. So one of the examples is creating charrettes. The Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, which is through the Mid-Michigan Program for Greater Sustainability, has been hosting a series of charrettes focused on the Michigan Avenue and Grand River Avenue corridor. And these are open to the public. It allows people to engage in a civil dialogue around important community issues, and it's kind of a collaboration between community members, the public, city planners, sustainability experts, and others who can really create a positive impact for this corridor.
Is a charrette something like maybe a little mini town hall?
Yeah, I think you can call it that.
Yeah, I'd never heard that word, and it was kind of an interesting word. So that is one of the ideas that you put out in your essay to increase civility in Michigan, this idea of increased collaboration in communities. But another idea you have is start a civil dialogue. How do you do that? What does that look like?
Right. And I think it really requires all citizens of Michigan to have an open mind. So citizens want to share their ideas. That's why they go into town halls and participate in public comments, because they want to have their voices heard. But I think that a civil dialogue is much different than a civil discussion. Rather, a civil dialogue means that we need to require more listening and for others to open their opinions and not having people attack those opinions, and just having an open mind and open to new perspectives and new solutions in order to kind of shift this society to more civility.
Emily, are there ways that we can actually practice this? What does this look like? How do we do this?
I think definitely learning about it. So this event that we're hosting at the Capitol is going to have a series of members from different academic institutions, the Kettering Foundation, Michigan State, the University of Michigan, Cornell. And it's really just learning about civility and what contributes to civility so that we can practice it in our daily lives. I think that everyone can practice civility no matter their occupation, whether they're a student, whether they're a politician, whether they're someone who's working in industry. I really think it just cultivating those connections with others is going to be imperative for civility.
So the event you were referring to, Emily, is MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development holding this event at the Capitol tomorrow, where you're going to be tackling this rise in incivility. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So it is going to be a half-day long event. It'll start at 8:30 in the morning in the rotunda of the Capitol building. And we're going to be having the Flint Youth Theater come and perform kind of an abstract theater presentation showing incivility, and we're going to have some storytellers kind of display what's going on. And then from there, the participants will go upstairs where they'll enter into these panels. There are different panels such as placemaking and how placemaking contributes to civility, or civility in the digital era is another one that we're going to be tackling. So I think it's just a unique opportunity for community members to engage in a civil dialogue and learn more about civility and civil theory. And at the end, if they'd like to get more involved, we're looking to put together kind of a working volunteer group to kind of help foster civility throughout Michigan.
Why is this an economic development issue, Emily?
I think in order to engage in a civil dialogue, in order to come up with those great innovative solutions, it's going to require people to work together. It's going to require that collaboration. And if you don't have that dialogue, and then you're just going to be kind of in this civility gridlock. And I think we try to solve these complex issues very quickly, but in that effort to respond quickly, we fail to comprehend the depths of the complexity in the issues that are in hand. So I think in order to move forward with progressing economic development, we really need to take a step back and reflect on how we are acting in order to help the next generation move forward.
Emily Bank, president of the Council of Graduate Students at Michigan State University. You can find her essay at the Next Idea page. Just go to michiganradio.org and share your thoughts and opinions on ways that we could improve civility in Michigan. You can do that in the comments section underneath Emily's essay, or go to Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or always on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. And thank you so much, Emily. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you. It was great talking with you as well.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.